Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, the human family, a community of peace. Pope Benedict reflects on the role of the family in promoting peace in today's world. Iraqi Christians living the life of refugees in nearby Syria, making the best of a bad deal. And we talk to the Knights of Malta after the Pope's visit to one of their Rome hospitals. The human family, a community of peace. That's the theme of Pope Benedict's message for the upcoming World Day for Peace, celebrated January 1st. In the message, released Tuesday in a Vatican press conference, the Holy Father urges world leaders to work towards an effective nuclear disarmament for a peaceful world. President of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Cardinal Renato Martino, introduced the message to the media.
This concern was initiated because we assist today to a renewed race to nuclear armaments. There are experiments done here and there, and also experiments of new weapons. And so this has to be stopped because nuclear weapons must never be used. Nuclear weapons means complete destruction, not only of those who we want to destroy, but also of those who use it. There is also a concern for the spreading of conventional weapons. Weapons are incompatible with peace.
Cardinal Martino says the Pope is also encouraging greater commitment to the environment.
The environment is important because the family lives in an environment. If the environment is contaminated, if it is polluted, this fact is not favorable to the development of the family, both the nucleus one and the human family. Also, we have a responsibility. We can use the creation, as we Christians say about environment, we can use the creation but not destroy it, because we have a responsibility for future generations. So we have to use it, improve it if it's possible, and transmit it to the future generations. And this is a duty, an obligation. And perhaps in the past the focus was not so direct on this problem, but I would like to remind that the chapter 10 of the compendium of the social doctrine of the Church is dedicated exactly to the environment.
Pope Benedict calls the family the first and indispensable teacher of peace. Bishop John Hine, chair of the English Bishops' Committee for the Family, says families must be helped to resolve conflict and overcome social injustice.
I think it's a great thing that he's doing this, because one of the most important aspects of the marriage relationship really is the whole area of conflict. It is said that more marriages break down because the partners have never had any help or instruction or assistance, really, in the whole area of conflict in relationship. And that's something which is part of every human relationship. And so we really do need to have help in that sphere. Peace is not just the absence of immediate conflict. Peace has to be based on justice. And I think it's true equally of the family, that if young people are brought up in a family where there is good communication, where people are respected and given their proper place, then they're far more likely to take this with them into their lives afterwards. And so that you get less competitiveness, less trying to put other people down, but a much more constructive way of living and relating, which I think spreads to the larger society.
And we'll have more coverage on Pope Benedict's World Peace Day message on January 1st. Don't miss it. Violence in Iraq has forced millions of Iraqis to flee their homes. And each month, Christians are among the 40 to 50,000 Iraqis who try to find refuge in a strange land. Though they account for just 3% of Iraq's entire population, Christians make up a full one-third of all Iraqi refugees. The figures, in fact, are staggering. 2 million Iraqis are now displaced within their own country. Another 2 million are believed to have fled to nearby nations like Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. Syria alone says some 1.4 million Iraqis have taken refuge in its territory over the last 3 years. Well, I talked with Bishop Antoine Odo, responsible for the Iraqi Chaldean Catholic community in Syria. I wanted to know how Iraqi refugees were coping there. We know that Iraq had a Christian community of about 800,000 people before the war broke out. Mm-hmm. Most of them were living in Baghdad or in Mosul. Mm-hmm. How many Christians do you think are left in Iraq right now?
I think half of the Christians moved from their homes. A quarter went to the north in the Kurdistan, and the other quarter are in Syria, in Jordan, and in Lebanon, and in Turkey. So I think a quarter are outside of Iraq, and a quarter went to the north.
We've heard some terrible reports of Iraqi Christians and Muslims being kidnapped, held for ransom, their churches being attacked. What are some of the stories that you've heard from the refugees themselves?
A lot of stories. For instance, the first which I remember, a young priest was kidnapping last September during 11 days in Baghdad with a big, difficult situation.
Yes, and we at Vatican Radio were following that story very carefully.
Yes, and he flew to Syria, and now he is with us in Damascus, helping us in the parish of Damascus, because we have between 35 and 40,000 Chaldeans, Iraqi, in Syria, in Damascus.
But he is not the only priest who found himself in serious difficulty there in Iraq. And I'm sure you've heard many stories from many Iraqi Christian families as well.
Yes. My experience is especially the situation of the ladies, the mothers, is pressing their life. They have the responsibility of the children, of the house, and generally we need to assist those ladies in a humanitarian way, psychological way. And really I am in admiration in front of them, this capacity to live, to organize themselves, to continue to be really present in the Syrian society.
Did many of these ladies have to leave their homes without their husbands or their brothers or their fathers?
Sometimes there is a situation of killing, situation of they leave the house to travel outside Iraq, to Europe, to the United States, to see for a job, to prepare the future of the family. Sometimes there is a problem of separation because a big crisis, a big trouble in the family's problem of morality. And so
most of the refugees, for example, in Syria, which, of course, you would know best, do not live in camps. But from what I understand, they've been able to rent small apartments or are staying with friends or places that have been offered to them by Muslim or other Christian organizations. Mm. Is this situation sustainable? I mean, are people able to work, find jobs? Kids, I understand, are able to go to school. Damascus is helping the Iraqi children to go to school.
Syria really did a lot for the Iraqi. They opened the borders. they opened the schools, the hospitals. Really, it's a very humanitarian attitude in this war. But how generally the Iraqis are living? I think the most of them, especially the Christians, they have a lot of support from their family in the United States, Canada, Australia, and Europe. In our family, there is a big solidarity, a spirit, the sense of the family. For instance, if a family in Syria, Iraqi family in Syria, receive $500 a month, for instance, one brother, one son, sent for his family $500, they will pay $250 to rent an apartment, and they will live with the other part. But in the same time, they can work, do some jobs to survive. We have to say we have in Syria Caritas, very well organized. We have different churches. For instance, our parish in Damascus, St. Therese of the Chaldeans, is very active. They will come families. They give help in the field of food, health, education. For instance, we have 1,000 children every week for the catechism. We rent a school in Damascus, and the buses have a special service every week to bring the children to the school, to have every Friday afternoon a time for catechism. And every year we have like 160 boys and girls to prepare for the first communion. We are an active church in the parish. Really, I am in admiration in front of those Christians who are able to continue to organize themselves, to be present and active in the church, in the heart of those difficulties.
We know that Syria has tried to stem the influx of Iraqi refugees by applying tougher visa restrictions. How has that affected the situation?
First, it creates a trouble, a fear, you know, because those families are in a situation without any law which protect them. They are accepted, they are tolerated, but they don't know for how many time. But generally, Syria, they accept them waiting a solution. So first, a psychological problem of fear to be put out. But I think Syria will not do this unless if there is a crime or trouble. This is the first point. Syria asked a visa in the beginning of October for two reasons. The first is that Syria, with 1,200,000 Iraqis, need a security and order in Syria. It doesn't want any trouble. So it limited this danger of violence in Syria. The second one, the Syria wants to do some pressure on the United States and the United Nations to ask serious help to pay for those refugees who are accepted in the schools, in the hospital. But in the same time, I was told that a lot of Iraqis continue to come to Syria, but they have now to pay something to get a visa on the border.
So what would you say then are the most urgent challenges that need to be addressed to improve the situation of the Iraqi refugees, and particularly the Christian refugees?
I think we have to continue our program. We don't have to stop. We have to continue with more organization. We need more professionalism in the helping the Iraqis. It's not enough to give some help from time to time. We need something well organized. And I think now Caritas has a good experience to improve their programs. This is what we need, some experienced personalities with experience, with doing a serious job, especially in Damascus, in Aleppo, and in Hasakeh, in Jazire.
Okay, and you think that the Syrian government has been assisting Christian aid organizations such as Caritas?
I think so. The government knows very well the situation, and especially Caritas is helping not only the Christians, but Caritas is really the organism of the church for everybody. And this is a very nice testimony. For instance, in Aleppo, we have a branch of Caritas with 1,000 families to have help from Caritas. And between those 1,000 families, 200 families are Muslim. It is really a good testimony, a good experience in the Christian society in Aleppo, when they see that Muslim Iraqis are coming to the church with the other Christians from Iraq to be together. It gives a good testimony for everybody, for Muslim and for Christian.
Bishop Antoine Odo is responsible for the Iraqi Chaldean Catholic community in Syria.
Cari cavalieri del sovrano militare Ordine di Malta, cari medici, infermieri e quanti qui lavorate, voi tutti siete chiamati a rendere un importante servizio agli ammalati e alla società, un servizio che esige abnegazione e spirito di sacrificio.
Pope Benedict XVI there speaking to members and staff of the Sovereign Order of the Knights of Malta, urging hospitals and healthcare workers to treat patients with love and to safeguard their dignity. The Pope was speaking at the beginning of Advent in a visit to a Rome hospital run by the Knights of Malta. I sat down with Gian Antioco Chiaveri of the Knights to talk about the Pope's visit and look at the Order's centuries-old tradition of caring for the sick.
Our order began 960 years ago in Jerusalem with the Hospital of St. John. The Blessed Gerard, our founder, built this hospital because he had to help the poor and the sick, especially the pilgrims coming from Europe to the Holy Land. And so this is how we began taking care of the sick of the poor. Tuitio Fidei Obsequium Pauperum are the guidelines of our order and has been for almost 1,000 years, and nowadays is exactly the same.
Of course, that's Latin, isn't
it? Defense of faith and the help to the more poor and the sick. Mm-hmm. We still do this. We still are very proud of doing the same thing since many, many centuries. And luckily, we don't have one hospital. We have more than 40 hospitals. We are in 120 countries in all over the world. And 12,500 are the members of the order. 80,000 are the volunteers. And almost 13,000 are doctors, paramedicals, and nurses that help us in doing this. So we grew a lot doing the same thing.
And of course, you had a very important visitor to one of your Rome hospitals.
Yes.
At the beginning of December, Pope Benedict XVI.
Absolutely a very important visit. Sunday, the 1st of Advent, His Holiness Benedict XVI came to visit our hospital of St. John in Rome. It's funny that the name of St. John of the Hospital of Rome is exactly the same name of the first hospital we built.
It was in Jerusalem.
960 years ago.
That's
yes.
Right.
And our Grand Master and the Sovereign Consul, together with their eminences, Cardinal Camillo Ruini and Cardinal Pio Laghi, which is the Cardinalis Patronus, it's the direct representative of His Holiness to our order, welcomed him to the hospital.
And it's in the outskirts of Rome, in the Rome suburbs, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. It's the Castello of the Magliana, which is, it's interesting to know that our hospital is built around this castle that has been for many centuries the summer residence of the popes. That castle is now also a school for nurses, so we have also that in the hospital. Mm-hmm. He came to celebrate the Mass for the sick and their families.
And how many sick do you have there?
We have 240 beds, and we can host 350 people for day hospital. And our hospital is very considered, let's say, in Europe for its neurological rehabilitation. Mm. And it is very important to know that when the Holy Father and the Mass decided to make a special visit to our reawaking unit, The reawaking unit of our hospital is one of the most important in Italy, and it is the most important of the center-south of Italy.
Wait, you have to explain that, the reawakening unit.
Yes.
Is that for patients who are waking up after an operation, or is it for comatose patients who actually wake up after being days or months in a coma?
The reawaking unit we have is for patients coming out of coma. So this unit is very specialized in, let's say, this rehabilitation therapy and for the people recovering from coma. So we have to have a very special care, not only of their psychological needs and their, obviously, physical needs, but also to help them and help them to come out from this situation. The unit was visited from His Holiness, and it has been a very special visit because he went to each of them, to each bed, and he looked at them with a very, paternal affection.
Mm-hmm.
And the families, the relatives that were around the bed that were already emotioned from his presence became really very, very emotioned from this, seeing him so involved. It looked like if he had been there so many times.
Hmm.
And so this was making even more special, this visit.
How many? You said there are about 40 patients?
No, 15, unfortunately. 15. We would like to develop it a little. But there isn't much in Italy of consideration for this specialized units. We make it, it's our own, but it should be more considered because obviously reawaking from coma is something very, very special. These people has to be helped. We have some machineries that put them vertical because if they come out from this situation, and hopefully, and sometimes they do, and so we hope they all will once, they need to be ready to live again. And so they have to be kept in alive, also their muscles, exercise, everything, to follow. They have our people speaking to them and telling them things, and this is very important. We do not really know what they can hear or not, but many times in many situations in the world, realize that they were hearing much more than what we thought.
And when you think of the euthanasia of comatose patients, we've heard in the United States a few years ago the story of Terry Schiavo.
Mm-hmm.
For the doctor, she was brain dead, but her family said, that she gave signs. She was sitting up. She was looking at you. She was communicating with her eyes and so on. It must be a field where your doctors as well, they feel a real strong commitment to this Catholic teaching of preserving life in all of its stages.
Absolutely. This helps a lot because if you have this point of view, it's easier for you to continue insisting and trying your best because you know that there is hope. The Holy Father, I go back to his visit and in the Mass, invited the sick, their families and all of us to find Christ, the hope and the support, saying that God mysteriously visits us. And only if we give ourselves over entirely to his will, we will experience his great love. And maybe this is resuming a little bit what was which were his words, were so many and so beautiful. But this hope, Spe Salvi, this encyclical, that letter
came
out 2 days before because it was the 30th of November. And in a certain way, he, through our sick people, through us, gave it to Rome, gave it to the Roman, and sent this message of hope. And certainly it was the right place to send a message of hope. And the strength of the families and of our sick proved how this message arrived very clear. Our point of view as members of the order is that each of our sick is representing the suffering of Jesus Christ. So it's easier for us to help our sick. It's not a job. It's something we like to do, and we always did.
The Knights have always been close to the popes for pretty much the entire history that you've been around. There continues to be a strong link between the Knights of Malta and the Holy Father. How would you describe this special relationship?
Sure. It is certainly a very special relationship. First of all, because our Grandmaster is the leader of a religious order. He has the rank of a cardinal for the Holy Church. And at the same time, we have an independent sovereignty. He's also a leader of a state. So we are completely independent. We have relations, we have diplomatic relations with 99 countries, included the Holy See. And for this reason, his, let's say, this double position of our Grandmaster is keeping us very near to the Holy See. And let's say that the Grandmaster thanked the Holy Father for coming and told him how much energy he was giving, and spiritual energy, because we are still inspired from his encyclical letter, Deus Caritas Est, which is so near to what we do. And our Grandmaster also told to the Holy Father how this visit was giving to us even more energy to continue what we're doing. On the other side, the Holy Father said, I mean, in this Mass, told to everybody that was there how he knows how since ever, because 960 years is a lot, since ever we are so devoted to the sick and to the poor. So this link is very natural. But let's think only of which are the purpose of the Holy Church and which are the purpose of the Order of Malta. The sick and the poor are certainly in the mind of anybody belonging to both, and obviously we belong to both.
You have 40 hospitals, you said, around the world. What sort of hospitals are these?
We have many different hospitals. Depends where we are. If we are in Africa, we will need certain hospitals with certain units organized for which are the problem of the sick of the area. We take care of people sick of AIDS, children sick of AIDS. We take care of many, many different diseases. So our hospitals are more specialized in each country for what is the need. I can tell you about a very special hospital, which is the one in the Holy Land, in Bethlehem. This hospital of the Holy Family does not look if they're Palestinian, Israeli, or whatever. The mothers just come there and have their child. It's important because since 1990, 37,000 children were born there. 15% of them were premature, and no child ever died in our hospital, and we're so proud of this. It's a
and
difficult
no mother
and no mother as well
died
and no childbirth. Mother as well. Mm-hmm. So this, in that situation, in that area, it is something special. We are very proud of this hospital of ours, and maybe this is a good occasion to explain how the Order of Malta is neutral.
So you don't look at a person's faith.
They can be Muslim
or Jewish, Christian. It doesn't matter.
We don't have any politics. We don't have any racial problem. This doesn't mean anything to us. We are devoted to the sick and the poor. We see anyway our Lord Jesus Christ in the sick and the poor. We don't check who they are and what they do. We just, each of them are for us exactly the same. They need our help and we are there for them.
Gian Antioco Chiaveri of the Knights of Malta.
Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.